And so the tribe is Man U, Louis Vuitton, Fendi, Montblanc. These are tribes. And so what we've done is we have outsourced our confidence and our self-worth to brands. And I was there. I didn't even know I was doing it. And so I think what we have to do is we have to individually connect with who we are and what we are, to let go of the need to like belong to these tribes. And what I love, that's what's starting to happen out there, and I think the younger generation are doing it, is they are extracting themselves from the world of these brands, and they're moving into something called quiet luxury. It means that you are very calm and clear in who you are, and you don't need a car, a brand, a team, a label to represent you before you arrive into a space, into a room.
Hi, and welcome to the Expansive Podcast, where we explore the frontiers of personal growth, business innovation, and technology. We believe that growth and progress comes from expanding our minds, exploring new possibilities, and embracing change. My name is Eric. I'm one half of the Expansive Podcast. And as always, I'm joined by my co-pilot and co-host, Mr. John Sonne, who is in a very chippery mood today, based on our...
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Hello, everybody. Wonderful to be back on the pod. We're very excited about this pod. We usually speak about 15 minutes before we get onto the pod. It's been 45 minutes now. Eric and I have been chatting off air before we even jumped on this pod. I think we've emptied all our stories. I don't know what we're going to talk about on this pod, but I'm kidding. We've already told and said and spoken about all sorts of things. So great to have you on. So much is going on in the world of AI. We are tracking it. And just this week, we had Sora being released. And so we'll chat about that today. But before we do, Eric, what's happening in Cape Town? How are you doing? How's Atlassian? How's life?
Yeah, no, life is good. Busy. Atlas is doing very well. Went for his first check-in today with the vet again for the year. And a healthy, happy pup. So all good. Yesterday, we went out for... a quick like sort of lunch and came back, and he literally chewed through my jumper cables because we closed down like all the doors when we leave, but we left the garage door open, and I come back and I just see like a jumper cable here, like a you know, he kind of distributed through the house. So
he was unhappy for being left at home, in other words.
He was unhappy for being left at home, and he made it known to us.
Yes.
But apart from that, yeah, things are going really well, working on some new ideas around content. Slowly, very, very, very slowly writing on a book. Sure, it's been...
Wow.
It's so funny that you... it's so funny that that's your response, because we used to write books all the time. Yeah. You know, like it was never a funny thing when one of us were busy with a book project, and like your response there is the perfect encapsulation of it.
Wow, I didn't know we're talking about the past. Oh, is this a historical book, Eric?
Yeah. Well, listen, ebooks and audiobooks are still doing very well. From what I believe they're still pumping. So anyway, so I'm slowly writing on that, and then I think just in general, like the year's kicked off on a good note. So lots of things to do and lots of things to get to. What's happening for you?
Awesome. I watched this TikTok of this somebody that went shopping and left their dog in the car and left the windows open. And then came back to the car and started calling the dog through the window because the window was open. And she's like, Charlie. And he just ignored her because he was so upset that she left him in the car. She's like, Charlie. He's like, just looking the other way, just not reacting to her, licking his lips. I thought it was so hilarious. These sensitive souls, you know, that are like, that are being left out, shame.
Yeah.
And we leave them out of so many different things. I had my publisher from America message me. It must be like the fifth time he's messaging me, asking me, where's my book? And my response to him was like, dude, I don't know. I've written like 20, 30,000 words. I'm bored. I don't know what else I need to do. Like, and he was like, well, send it to me. Let me see what we can do with it. I was like, I don't really want to send it to you because it's not really where I want it to be. But anyway, here it is. I don't know. Do whatever you want to. It's funny. I feel zero motivation to write a book. Zero. Absolutely zero. It just feels so slow.
It is slow.
I think it is so slow. And what we have to realize is what AI is doing actually is creating something called AI fatigue. And AI fatigue is we have such an abundance of words and pictures, and soon it will become moving pictures, movies, is that we are going to be totally fatigued by amazingness, amazing words, amazingly structured books, amazing movies, amazing pictures. I mean, think about the number of pictures you've seen from AI that are gobsmacking, thinking about something, I don't know, God and his angels, and just the way it comes up with that. And then you watch Sora and what Sora has been doing with like 1 minute clips, and you're like, what? And then it's like just AI fatigue. And so when it comes to writing books, it's just like, I don't know, it feels dated all of a sudden, like very dated all of a sudden. And maybe I'm not a sentimental guy. I'm not like romantically connected to the past. Some people are, and I get that. And some people love still reading a newspaper on a Sunday if you're 87 in the shade. But either way, that's kind of, it's like nostalgia, right? I got no nostalgia. That's just my personality. So I don't know, when you say writing a book, I'm like, wow, I'm actually quite surprised, because like,
look, there's another aspect to it. There's another aspect to it, which is that I think what we also seeing is AI laziness, you know, which is that you jump onto ChatGPT and instead of you sitting with the idea and fleshing it out and fighting through it, you're expecting ChatGPT just to give you the answer. And it'll give you the answer, but it's still a prediction model. So it's still going to give you the most obvious answer. So writing for me has always been thinking. And I think that's what I've started to miss and why I've been trying to get back to it, is that I know that when I'm writing, I'm testing myself in terms of how well I know something, but I'm also connecting dots that previously I might have missed. And I'm also generating new ideas.
Fair.
And so I've kind of become weary of this idea that I'm just relying on AI to do my writing for me. And I think maybe over time we'll see a bit of a, you know, maybe there's some distinction that starts happening between people who are using AI for all their writing and kind of outsourcing their thinking versus like, because that's what always, that to me, that's what's made writing hard, is that you have to put into words what's in your head and you have to wrestle with it and you have to think about the best way to present it. And I've kind of missed that.
I think also, you're right. And again, I think it's a very personal thing. I think some people think better writing. Mm-hmm. I think when I'm talking. And so I've actually, all my books have been sort of like dictated, because that's where I'm doing my thinking. And I've always just related my thinking in words into books, not the other way around. So now that all of a sudden we've got the pod and we've got other opportunities to share our thinking, it's almost also why I don't want to get another tattoo. Because I got my tattoos 20 years ago. And like somebody said, when are you getting your next tattoo? I'm like, I got different ways to express myself now. Like it used to be the way to express myself. Now I don't need to write on my body that I love my granddad. I mean, I love my granddad. Why do I need to write it on my body? But I did 25 years ago, because that was the way I expressed myself then. So I do think it's just a change of expression. Mm. And I think we just have new ways to express ourselves. And books, yes, if that's the way you think and the way you write, and yes, that's absolutely valid for you to be doing that, you know?
Look, and I still think books are a great container, you know? And we speak about containers all the time. It's like, you want to have a container for money. You want to have a container for your ideas. And I often find that, like, so The Best of Us, for example, like there's a lot to the idea that can't just be expressed in, you know, videos over time or podcasts over time. You want to take all of that and say, here's the complete package. You don't have to go look anywhere else for it. But apart from the book, I've actually been really craving just writing more, like outside of the book, because I think exactly to what you're saying is that there are certain ways for us to stimulate our thinking. I don't know if I do enough talking for that to be my way of stimulating thinking. I think it has for me to be in writing. And also what I find is that when I can't write, it's because I don't have enough new inputs.
That's true.
And so it becomes a good forcing function to realize, oh, actually, like the reason why you feel stifled is because you've kind of relaxed on the input side of it. So to increase output, go increase input.
Right.
Yeah. So I think it's just a nice kind of forcing function for me, for creativity.
Great.
Yeah.
Great. Okay. Well, good, man. I'm glad I look forward to seeing that book when it's ready. And obviously, it's going to be about history of leadership, right? It can't be about the future of leadership because that's what books are. They only really tell us about history.
Well, I think what's also going to be different about this book is it's not going to be a big book at all. I actually think what's more important is, I can't remember who I was listening to the other day. I almost want to say it was Seth Godin, but it might have been someone else, who said that about 60 to 70% of their book sales come from Audible and from ebooks. And so what was interesting about that was that it's not actually about writing a long book, because when you're consuming it in that format, you don't care about how big the book is, right?
Like, yes,
you care about getting the idea. And so actually, like, if I'm going to buy...
That's so true.
Yeah. And when I buy an Audible book, I often filter and I look at the length. How long is it going to take me hours-wise to get through this? And I'd much rather buy something that I can listen to an hour and a half and I'm going to get all the information than having to slog through your, like, boring, unnecessary stories for 6 hours.
Yes. And all books are boring and unnecessary after 20,000 words, to be honest with you.
I think so
too,
because
you get the idea in 20,000 words. The last 20,000 words is because the publisher forced you to write those so that it looks like you're getting value when you buy it off the shelf. That's what I keep getting told by my publishers. I'm like, guy, I'm done with it. I don't want to write anything else. They're like, no, you need to fill it up. I'm like, I don't need to fill it up. I don't want to fill it up.
And then...
So yeah, okay.
Which is another thing. I'm not going to be publishing this book through... like publishing. I just want to write it for ebooks and for Audible. Yeah. Because the world is changing. Okay. It is different. And I don't want this to go live on a shelf. I want it to be available mostly as a digital format book. And, you know, I think there's a space where, like, Blinkist is too short. You know, Blinkist is like, you get the high level idea, but you lack the stories that give you the integration. Whereas like a full book,
I agree.
Like you were saying, it's just too much. And then you kind of get lost in the weeds. So yeah, I think 20,000 words, you get to communicate an idea very clearly, very sharply, and include enough examples and stories that people can integrate it. And so that's actually what I'm kind of heading for, is I want to, over time, build up a container of like all these different ideas that are short and to the point, and they just kind of live in book form.
I love it.
Yeah.
That's a really good idea. It's actually the idea I've had for my own book as well, just to let you know. I'm kidding. Yeah, that's really great. I love that. I did something off-air. Eric showed me his new talk. I was like, that's a really good name. It's funny. I've also named my talk that. Just kidding. It's not my talk. I want to talk about a video I saw on TikTok that really has had me thinking. But before I tell you about the video, I just want to tell you about what I think is going on in the world. Because we have more access to more information, to more therapists, to more drugs, and I mean pharmaceutical drugs as well as illegal drugs. We have more access to more things. I mean, in fact, anybody listening to this most probably has 3 or 4 apps that alone can deliver 400 different meals from 75 different countries at a finger, at the push of a button. We've got so much available to us, and many people feel fatigued, feel exhausted, feel frustrated, feel lost, feel so many different things. And this is with all the trappings of success. We're not talking about people that have nothing, because that's a different world. And people listen to this podcast are pretty successful. We are pretty successful. We're in the top echelons of society, thank God. And so these are the people that we hang around. And these people feel empty with so much of everything around us. And so I made a post a little while back that said, if you're feeling fatigue, it might not be because you're tired. It might be because you feel betrayed by the system. And you can't actually put that into words, because you don't know why there's a level of emptiness. You don't know why there seems to be no purpose, because you are doing everything you were told to do. Like, go to school, be a good student, get the degree or get the marks, go to university, get the job, follow the process, get married, be a good citizen, pay your taxes. And here you are, in whatever age you are, with all the success, inverted commas and close inverted commas, and you feel empty. And you can see this because the number of pharmaceutical companies that are shooting the lights out tells us that there's something wrong in the society, that we are drugging ourselves, numbing ourselves, uplifting ourselves. I mean, you and I have a coffee every morning when we wake up. It's an upper. And then maybe you have a glass of whiskey, I have something else, or to a downer. And so we have this sort of like up, down, not quite happy with things, need to be somewhere else, need to do more. And there's something wrong with the system of more and debt. So we've got this two things, right? You've got debt that's been created so that you can create more money in the system. And you've got marketing and consumerism that kind of is what's supposed to make you happy. That's the system that's been told. It's like, once you've made all that money, success looks like you buying the new Mercedes-Benz and you buying the new thing. And every time you do that and you get a bigger home, you should be more happy. But the truth is that's not true, because we've done it and the world's not in a good place.
Mm.
And this has been on my mind for so long, because as successful as I am and I'm doing everything I dream about doing, I'm traveling, I'm about to go and speak for NASA and I'm about to go into Philippines. I'm doing everything. But sometimes I think to myself, what am I doing? I'm making money. So now I'm thinking, shit, I need to diversify my money. Like, now I've created a whole new issue that I'm now stressing about. And then I saw this video, and this video has stuck with me. And it was about this influencer being giddy, like he or she, I can't remember now, but giddy, so excited to be going to a Fendi store to get an option to look at, and I'm not kidding here, £100,000 handbag. This handbag is big enough for your cell phone and two lipstick pieces. That's it. I mean, it's just, there's nothing else. And this person was so excited to be going to the shop. Now, everybody in the shop is wearing gloves. God forbid your human hands touch these handbags. And now everything is such a big story about this exclusive, one-of-a-kind Fendi handbag made by, I don't know, Cow and her sister, and I don't know who's made it. But I just sat there and I thought to myself, this is the world we live in, where we have an incredible level of disparity of wealth, with debt, with frustration, with a betrayal of the system. And here we are prizing somebody spending £100,000 on a bag. And I thought, there's something massively wrong here. And then I read an article that said, if monkeys would hoard the bananas that they only needed to eat one banana a day, but there was one monkey that would hoard all the other bananas while the other monkeys starved to death, they would study this monkey to understand what is the psychosis and craziness that this monkey is having, that it can't share its bananas with the rest of the monkeys. And I thought to myself, hang on a second. What is going on? We've got people that are hungry, poor, not being able to pay for their monthly rent. And then we've got somebody talking about £100,000 bag that is just useless. And I feel deflated by the system of consumerism and marketing. I feel betrayed by it. And I think I'm only starting to feel this now because I've woken up to it. And I think I was suffering from it for so long. And when I was in my 20s, I was so in the matrix that I could never leave my home without a Lacoste t-shirt, a Montblanc pen, a Panerai watch, an M3 car. God forbid my M3 was in for a service. I couldn't really go out. I mean, where would I park and who would see me? And I remember this one guy in Cape Town, and I won't say his name, but he would always drive this Porsche, and I knew he had inherited the money. And this one time, his car was in for a service, and he had a Toyota Corolla as a fill-in car while his car wasn't a thing. Dude, the guy parked blocks away and then walked because he didn't have his Porsche with him. And then you see people that are totally hooked into following teams. And so sometimes you go onto somebody's Instagram or whatever, and you see Manchester United fan or Chelsea fan. And then you think about, hang on a second. So what's happened to this human being is that individually, they're not good enough. So they have to attach themselves to a tribe, and they get worthiness from their tribe. And so the tribe is Man U, Louis Vuitton, Fendi, Montblanc. These are tribes. And so what we've done is we've outsourced our confidence and our self-worth to brands. And I was there. I didn't even know I was doing it. And I've got really, really good friends. Like, I love these friends. I've had them for 30, 40 years. But I was recently at their house, and they were all had this certain bag. I think it's Coutard or I don't know, some brand. And I was like, oh, that's a nice brand. And they're like, do you know this bag? I'm like, no, I don't know. What is this bag? It's like, no. It's from a very specific shop in Italy. There's only three of them in the world. We had to queue. I mean, this bag here is like $10,000. I was like, it's just a normal bag, but because of this branding. And I sat there and I thought to myself, my good friend, who's highly intelligent, is outsourcing his self-worth so that makes sure when he goes to the restaurant, he puts that bag onto the table so that other people that are also outsourcing their level of confidence and self-worth can see that he's part of that tribe. And so I think what we have to do is we have to individually connect with who we are and what we are to let go of the need to like belong to these tribes. And what I love that's what's starting to happen out there, and I think the younger generation are doing it, is they are extracting themselves from the world of these brands, and they're moving into something called quiet luxury. And it doesn't mean you have to be a beggar or a bum or a minimalist. It means that you are very calm and clear in who you are, and you don't need a car, a brand, a team, a label to represent you before you arrive into a space, into a room. And actually, and ultimately, and this is the last piece I'll say about this, because this has been sitting heavy on my heart, because I think it's just my own journey as well. But you're a prisoner of those brands. Like, I was a prisoner of not being able to leave my house without my M3, and this guy in Cape Town not being able to arrive at a party with his Porsche. He's a prisoner of those brands. And those brands, and I got to take my hat off to Fendi. Well done. How genius is that brand to position themselves in a place where their handbags are untouchable and unreachable, and they cost £100,000, and people are lining up to be near it, and it's a piece of leather with a clasp. Like, hats off, Fendi. You have a marketing genius brand. But for the humans out there that are attaching themselves to these brands, can you not see that you're stuck? Like, can't you see that you're stuck in a prison? Like, surely you can. Like, it's a tough place to be. And so, yeah, that's the end of my rant. Any comments?
Yeah, no, I mean, I fully agree with you. I've also heard a different definition of quiet luxury, where a lot of the luxury, like, you know, you get like middle of the road, then you get like premium, and then you get luxury, and then you get ultra luxury. And so there are like brands like Loro Piana. Loro Piana.
G-Stud.
Yeah.
The guy from G-Stud. Yeah.
Yeah. From Succession.
G-Stud guy.
They wear a lot of that stuff. And so like a cashmere sweater from Loro Piana is like $4,000, you know. What I've seen, what's happened is that they remove all their logos and all the branding. So the quiet luxury comes in that you are buying these ultra, ultra luxury things, but they aren't screaming brand. They don't have all of the logos and whatever on it. But I think what you know, ultimately what it comes down to, what you said, is that it's a realigning just of values. Because I you know, and we had a similar conversation offline. I love premium goods. I love buying into things that I perceive as quality. And very often the things that are more expensive are things that are, they have better materials they've used, a more thoughtful crafting process. And yes, I do like that brand says something about who I am. There's something that I resonate with in what this brand stands for, or what they, how they position themselves. But I think that the difference is that you aren't hooked into the system. You are very consciously making decisions about what you want to buy. And it kind of, when you were speaking about it, it almost sounded to me like the addiction of consumerism, the addiction of just buying, the addiction of outsourcing. So in Twitter, you were saying outsourcing who you are to the brand, instead of like, this brand is just like, I actively choose it rather than I choose it because I'm influenced by the world around me. And I remember when I was doing lots of individual coaching, one of the things we always tried to do was to clarify people's goals. And it sounds like such an easy thing to do, because surely you have a good idea of who you want to be and where you want to go. Surely those things are clear. But the moment you start like fiddling with it a bit, you realize that very often the goals that we have and the person that we want to be has been influenced by the people around us. And what the term for it is, mimetic desire, is that I'm miming what I see around me. And so actually, it becomes very tough to really know, this is who I want to be. This is influenced by me. This is what I really want. This is who I really want to be. And I think in a world that is very busy, very distracted, full of brands shouting at us all day long, every day long, and pouring lots of marketing spend into it, it's so easy to just become part of the whole, just become part of like this big homogenous machine that's moving, you know?
But remember, I mean, that's what the system wanted you to do, is to fit into it, right?
Yeah.
And so the more you followed the system, whether it was school, organization, religion, brands, is almost like another religion. It's like you belong to this other religion. It used to be being a Christian or Catholic. Now it's Louis Vuitton.
Yeah.
It's like a different religion.
Yeah. Well, I think none better than the religion of Apple, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And, I'm definitely in that space. And maybe the way I justify my Apple purchases, because it's my business, I don't see it as a luxury. I see it as a benefit to the way I move. But yes, I'm not a monk. I also buy things, but more and more, I'm trying to understand £100,000 bag. Like, that is ridiculous. It's just ridiculous. Like, on so many levels, when there's people that are in dire straits and you're paying for that.
Yeah.
And then you're making a TikTok about it. You know?
Well, even when you think about think about the Stanley Cup craze as well, that they had to limit people to only buying two at a time, for example.
Yes.
You know, because everyone is buying it, I want to have it. And because everyone is buying it, the more I can have, the better. The more I can have the exclusive ones, the better. But I think Apple started a lot of this, to be honest, because that was the first time, at least in my understanding, like from what I can remember, when Apple started coming out with their products. Like, you know, they were okay for a while, and then they really stepped up their game when Jobs came back. And it was in that era when it was the first time I saw people camping out overnight to buy a product the next day.
Yeah.
It almost feels to me like they kind of engineered that anticipation. And today we see it for lots of brands and lots of things.
Anyway, I think it's just the rant, this video really got under my skin. I couldn't believe that people are doing this. And I think just the shout out is, who are you and what makes you tick? And do you have to attach yourself to that brand? And if you do, ask yourself why. Like, what are the benefits you're getting out of it? And yeah, I think it's just, and I've also put this on LinkedIn once or twice, like the ultimate luxury is really time and health. And then somebody commented, so is handbags. And I was like, I don't know if that's I don't know, you know, not in my world. Anyway, that's my rant for the week. Thank you very much.
I really like that. I really like that. I also have a bit of a rant for the week.
Yes.
And mine is in a bit of a different space. It's back to the world of work and leadership.
Mm-hmm.
And I've, you know, the work that I do is mainly kind of in two camps. In the one camp, you have workshops and keynotes. And then in the other camp, you have longer form team and leadership development. And like, I've been doing workshops now for many, many years. And I always find that the same thing happens when we deliver workshops, which is that we do the workshop on the day. And it goes really well. You get to the end of the day, people feel fired up. They feel like they've created something new. But then coming out of that, when you check in with people, you know, a month or so later, you go like, well, so what has happened since then? They go, nothing. Like nothing has changed.
Yeah.
And I've actually come to the realization a while ago that when we see dysfunction in a team, we often have one of two approaches. The one approach is we do nothing and we hope it goes away. And the second approach is we like, we need to go run a workshop because we're going to fix this issue at the workshop. And the outcome of those two approaches is exactly the same, which is that nothing changes.
Yeah.
And so I think what needs to happen is leaders really need to recalibrate their relationship that they have with workshops. I think we're judging it on the wrong merit. We are judging workshop based on, can it change people's behavior in the long run? That's actually not what a workshop is for. A workshop is to get into the room and to be creative and to be innovative. And the main function of it is ideation, is that by the time we are done, we have started looking at a problem, we've identified what that problem is, and we've come up with potential solutions for that problem. the workshop is not about the execution that happens afterwards. That's a different system that we need to think about. What a workshop is for is to get the group to really tap into their collective wisdom, is to use people to solve complex problems. And if you've done that on the day for a workshop, that workshop is successful.
I was going to say, you know, I often use this. Somebody says to me, they've said to me in the past, so when you do your talk, what happens in that company afterwards? I said, that's not my issue. It's like, it's not my issue. And also, like, a personal trainer trains you for an hour. Does the personal trainer worry if you're going to eat a pizza later? It's not his issue. It's not her issue. That's your issue. You have to take responsibility at some point for implementing some of the thinking. And so sometimes they want to just blame it. And when I was younger, I used to take on that sort of responsibility. I don't anymore. I'm like, you're crazy. It's nothing to do with me if you apply it or not. I can't go to a Dr. Joe Dispenza retreat and come home and go, oh, you know, nothing changed. Well, did you keep meditating? Oh, no, I didn't. Oh, well, then what must I do? Yeah.
Exactly. And so, you know, what I always say is that what we get wrong at a workshop is we are evaluating people's willingness. And I think we've actually spoken about this before, is we are evaluating their willingness to change at the workshop. You know, so yes. We sit in the Friday, yes. We go, are we willing to change? And we go, yes, of course, we're willing to change.
And who wants to change? No, not yeah. me, not me.
Yeah. We get to the office on Monday, there are fires burning, people want your attention. And all of a sudden, instead of doing the new thing, you go back and you do the old thing. What we need to measure instead isn't people's willingness to change, but their willingness to be inconvenienced. Because if we are honest about it, on Monday, when you walk into the office and there are fires burning and people that need your attention and things that are falling apart, and you get to that moment where you have to choose between the new way and the old way, for you to choose new is an inconvenience. It is difficult in the moment. It is going to be challenging. And so,
of course,
actually, that's the commitment that we need to make, is that when we sit in the workshop, we are committing to be inconvenienced moving forward, to choose the new thing until the new thing becomes much easier. Now we are dealing with reality.
Are you willing to be inconvenienced? That's the sort of, that should be part of your questionnaire before you go into a workshop.
Yeah, I always open with that, because I'm like, I want you to be committed to this. And if we can acknowledge that you choosing the new thing is going to be difficult, both cognitively and physically, yeah. then we are already starting to deal with reality. Because, so here's the second part of this, is that once we've created the outcome in the workshop, once we've ideated and we've found a solution, once you get into the office on Monday and you are dealing with the reality of the team and the reality of your day-to-day, all of a sudden you might find that what we created doesn't quite fit into the reality of what you have. And so what we need to do then is we need to tweak it and mold it and shape it until it starts making more sense. And so that's what the system is really important for. It's like, we need to have a system where we go, okay, well, we'll meet every single week for the next 8 weeks and we'll talk about this. We'll debrief this and we'll go, where was this easy? Where did you fail? And what did you learn? And in the process, what we're doing is we're taking this thing that we created. You know, there's a whole idea that when you initially launch a product or a service and you launch it into the market, like, it never survives first contact with the market. Like, it always has to change.
Yes.
It's the same with this. Like, you can't expect what you create on a weekend away to fit perfectly into the reality of the team. And so now we go through this process of molding and shaping and forming it until it starts making more sense. But we have to have that system in place. And so actually these days, I almost never sell a workshop without 4 follow-on sessions where we get to tweak and alter and make sure we need to make the modifications that fit into the team.
Nice.
So it's just a big rant to say, when you think about workshops, think about it purely on the merit of ideation. That is what you are trying to do. You are trying to solve a problem. You are trying to find the solution to a dysfunction in the team. Once you've done that, that workshop has been successful. It's done what it needed to do. Now, for you to go and implement that, the execution phase of that is a different system. And that different system is most likely some sort of weekly follow-up session that you run where you are looking at the behavior, how it's being implemented. There's accountability for it, but there's also iteration on it. And ultimately, if you do that, you are way more likely to see changes in behavior and culture and performance than hoping that a workshop fixes your team and your company and your culture.
I love that. But you've also got to take into account that the people that have got a dysfunctional team are the ones that don't want to take responsibility. So it's very easy for them to blame the person they thought was being hired to actually give them the answers of their own behavior change or their team's behavior change where they didn't have to evolve. And for them to point fingers at you is easy. It's like, oh, it was you. I paid you and my team's not reacting to me the way I wanted to. Which means that, wow, that person's stuck deep inside their own victim mindset, you know, not able to actually see it. So does that person who complained to you listen to the pod, Eric? Is what I want to know.
Listen. They don't.
Shout out to Sarah. Shout out to Melissa from that insurance company. Good luck out there. Chop. Anyway, here we go.
Thank you so much. Yeah. So listen.
My pleasure.
Good pod. Really enjoyed that. To everyone listening, thank you so much for spending time with us today. We always love coming onto the pod. It is, it really is a fun time in the week always just to banter and have some fun, have some laughs. Like, honestly, my sides are actually sore, like from before we started with the pod today. And I could feel it in my cheeks. So thank you for that. Yeah. It puts me in a good mood for the rest of the day as well. And to everyone listening, we love having you along on this journey. We are now starting to move towards our 300th episode. That's going to be the next big milestone, 200 episodes deep. And we look forward to continuing this journey with you. We have some exciting things that are coming up. We are bringing some friends onto The Expansive. And we'll tell you more about that. We have a new series that we are launching and we'll tell you a bit more about that. So just know that there are many new developments and ideas coming to The Expansive, and we want to share that all with you soon. So thank you very much. Make sure to share this with a friend or a family member or a colleague who needs to hear this. Share it with a leader who needs to know a bit more about workshops. And until next time, see you soon.
Ciao.